Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hello. Oh my goodness. It's the final podcast. Not ever, but this is the last episode of the first series of Spinning Plates. It's kind of flown by. How crazy is that? I suppose when you do something weekly, it becomes a little marker. Oh, that's funny. That reminded me of, like, the kitchen discos that we did during lockdown were like that. You kind of go, oh, it's Friday again. And now I've got this lovely podcast thing going on. And it's like, oh, it's Monday again. Let's put another one. And listen, thank you so much for joining me on this new adventure. I've loved doing this podcast, you know. It's been so something I've been very selfish about. I've just been interviewing and talking to really lovely women. And it's encouraged me to be a bit bolder about approaching people I don't know already. Which, you know, I'm fundamentally fairly shy, to be honest with you. So initially, sending out little emails to people saying, would you like to talk to me? I was just cringing the whole way through it. But everybody's been so nice. And I've been so fascinated by everybody I've been speaking to. And I've learned so much that it's really, it's made me a little bit bolder, actually. So if you think of anyone you think I should talk to for the next series, will you please tell me in the comments? Because I'm kind of keen to keep casting my net far and wide. I'm quite excited about it all, really. Keep thinking of new people and thinking, oh. And actually, the guest this week is someone I didn't know before. Her name's Hadley Freeman, and I just loved her writing. And so I was really keen to speak to Hadley because I think she's super bright and really funny and just, yeah, love the person she seems on paper. I've read her books, and I've also read her when she writes for The Guardian. And yeah, so she was so lovely and open to talking to me and so brilliant. And actually, I've thought about our chat a lot since I met with her because there's so many things she said that really resonated with me. She's, you know, quite open about the fact she had anorexia when she was a teenager and how that she felt that kind of gave her a bit of arrested development. And I think that really makes me think, you know, we're so in a hurry with ourselves to kind of feel like we're fully formed versions of ourselves, really quite young, you know, we're in our 20s, but really growing up takes a really long time. I'm still doing it now, and that's okay. I mean, obviously I'm an adult and I'm responsible, but I'm definitely still, you know, hopefully evolving. I say hopefully. It's not guaranteed, guys. It's not guaranteed. Anyway, I also really want to speak to Hadley, not just because I think she's bright and funny, but also because she's a writer. And I thought, golly, when I think of people who work from home and also have young kids, Hadley has twin boys who I think are four and a little girl who's, well, she might be two by now, but she was, I think, 1.5 when we spoke back in March. Because I've been bouncing around with the chronology during the series. I didn't want it all to be talking about blooming coronavirus all the time. So, yeah, this was pre-lockdown, actually. But I thought, how do people work from home when they're writing? Anyway, you can hear me talk to Hadley about that and about her Jewish heritage, which features in a book she's just written called House of Glass, which is a beautiful book about her grandma. And we talk about her dog Arthur, and we talk about kids. Of course, as you'd expect, a podcast about working mothers. Golly, sorry, my introductions are getting more ridiculous each week, aren't they? Yeah, I am one of those people that phone someone, and then when I get to their voicemail, I leave a full voicemail message of the conversation that I think we were going to have on the phone call, only without their reply. So essentially, that's what I'm doing with you now. See, I can talk to you about everything and I don't even need you to respond. But I am going to stop talking now because I think what Hadley has to say is far more interesting than my rambling on. Anyway, thank you so much. My final guest of the first series of Spinning Plates, the wonderful Hadley Freed. Hadley, I'm so excited to meet you and thank you so much for letting me come to your house and talk to you today.
No, thank you, Sophie. So sweet.
Well, so I don't know how much of it I've explained, really. I've been basically starting this podcast, which is all about working mothers, because I've been working as a musician since I was late teen, but I have also been raising a family. I now have 5 children and... I think I find there's a bit of a duality between half of me feeling like really empowered and feeling like I can do anything because I've got these sons and it's all going to be fine, but also feeling a little bit like there's a little mum's net for him in my head also, sort of saying like, you're probably not getting it all done right. And I think no matter who you are, what you're doing, if you're a working mother, you've probably got similar sort of sides of your brain.
100%. And also when you have to go away for work, which I do quite a lot, and I have my boys, so I've got 4-year-old twin boys and an 8-month-old baby. And I'll say to my boys, I'm going to miss you so much while I'm away. And one of them said to me the other day, then why do you keep going away?
Oh.
It's so heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's quite a good one, isn't it?
So totally. I mean, no matter what you're doing, you're thinking you're not doing it entirely right. But then I've got friends who are mothers who don't work and they have feelings about that. And I've also got friends who work and don't have children and they have feelings about that. So I also know there's no one situation where you feel totally confident about what you're doing.
No, that's true. And the reason why I wanted to speak to you is because, firstly, I adore your writing.
Oh, thank you.
But also, to me, one of the most challenging ideas is being something like an author when you're also raising a family. And not only do you have 3 children, as you say, your daughter's really little. She only born, is it last July?
June, so she's 8 months.
Okay, yeah. So really little.
Yeah.
But you've also just released this incredible book.
Yes, I know. This stupid book. I mean, obviously, excellent book that everyone must buy immediately. I did most of the research for it long before the children were born, long before I knew my husband, because I made such a meal of this research. It took me 18 years.
Wow.
And then I started writing the book 18 months ago. So I was pregnant with her for most of the writing. And I finished the writing the week before she was born. And I thought, wow, look at me, I'm so capable. But what I forgot was that I then have to edit all the proofs. And I took 4 months off from maternity leave, and I spent the entire of my maternity leave on my bed editing proofs. I had this whole planned idea. I'd be like, you know, wafting around the Tate Modern, going to the Wolseley with my baby. Because last time I had twins and I couldn't leave the house. And this time I was like, whoa, with a single baby, I can go out and do things. But no, I was fully on my bed just reading proofs with the baby. So that was a bit of a drag.
Well, we're kind of touching now on loads of things I want to talk to you about, because I suppose firstly we should start with, what have you got going on with your work at the moment? Tell us a little bit about your book, House of Glass.
So my book's just come out, and it's the true story of my grandmother and her 3 brothers who were in Paris in the run-up to the war, and it's what happened to each of them over the course of the 20th century. And it took me so long to do, partly for practical reasons and I think also partly for emotional reasons, if I'm honest, because it was kind of painful asking some questions. But just practical stuff, I had to travel all around France and Poland and America, going to archives and talking to historians and finding all this stuff because I wanted it all to be true. I didn't want it just to be a collection of family anecdotes because no one needs that. So that's now done and it came out last Thursday. So I'm having to do lots of promotion for that. At the same time, I am full-time staff writer at The Guardian, where I've been 20 years this June, which is the most tragic thing I've ever said.
Congratulations, that's cool.
Is that cool or is that actually kind of sad?
No, I don't think it's sad.
Same job for 20 years. So I'm trying to coordinate stuff around that. And the three kids. I took 4 months maternity leave, which people think is a really short amount of time, but I am very lucky in that I can work from home. So usually, like on a normal working day, you know, I take the boys to their little nursery around the corner. I come home, I have the baby for about half an hour, then the childminder turns up. And I go up to my study and then I come down for lunch and I have lunch with the baby and then I go back upstairs and the boys come home and they come up and give me kisses. I keep working till about six and then I come down and then I take over.
Okay, so you have a space in the house where you go and they know that that's your working space.
I mean, they know it. That doesn't necessarily keep them out of it, but they know where it's next to their room as well.
Right.
But that's quite useful at night, especially when I was working on the book. I would put them to bed and then I could go into my study to work and I would hear if they were crying or if they needed me. So I quite like it. I want to hear what they're doing.
Yeah, no, I think, if that works for you, I suppose, you know, if you're someone that writes, and especially with the stuff at The Guardian, it's so much about keeping your sort of clear voice. It's quite impressive to me, actually, that having the kids next door has actually helped you sort of keep that clarity of who you are in amongst it, because it could actually sort of trigger the part of your brain that means you can suddenly, all you can do is think about what they're doing.
I mean, I say it helps that they're next door. It helps when they're next door and sleeping. Yeah. I mean, when they're playing, they're downstairs in the kitchen, which is two floors below. So that's fine. And there are these blessed silicone earplugs from Boots, which are always good at blocking out the world. So it's fine. And I actually haven't found that having kids has affected my work that in a negative way. If anything, it's just kind of made me get on with things. I certainly dicked around over this book for, like I say, 18 years. And I think it's sort of telling that I finally started to write it when the boys were three and then I got pregnant. And that kind of put the fire under me. I just thought, I've got to do this now. I don't know how you do things with five kids, Sophie, but I just thought once I have three, I'm never going to be able to accomplish a book like this again.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I wonder what it is about having the kids that did mean you suddenly felt like that sort of fire of like, got to get this done now.
Well, I think it really wasn't until I had the twins that I sort of began to take myself seriously as a grown-up, which is terrible because I was 37 when they were born. So I definitely still thought of myself as a teenager for way too long and just thought, I'm a young person. Why expect things from me? I'm just having fun. I can write funny things in The Guardian and that's enough. And suddenly I had these kids and I thought, oh, actually, I'm a grown-up. Maybe it's now time to do the things that I want to do as a grown-up. So they definitely made me grow up, and I'm certainly not saying that people, you know, only grow up when they have kids. This is just a sign of me and my emotional immaturity that it took until having kids to grow up.
Yeah, no, I think for me, I totally agree. It's really important to me that the distinction is not saying, if you're someone that's working and you have kids, boy, do they really make things work better. It's not that. So it's actually more about reassuring, you know, yourself and other people that you can still get things done. You can actually still achieve a lot at a time when you normally are quite worried that that's never going to happen again. And I know that when I first got pregnant with my first baby, I was really scared. Like, what happened if I can never write a song again? What happens if my voice sounds different? What happens if I feel daft standing on stage? It just felt almost so abstract. I couldn't imagine having those two sort of hats I'd be putting on all the time. But actually, you do gain confidence and you do get better with the focus, I think.
Yeah, and also you appreciate the times away. Mm. Whereas before, it was just kind of working, you're doing whatever. And it is hard. It's definitely hard going away. I went on my first big work trip in January. I was away for a week in Los Angeles. And leaving the house, leaving the baby behind, she was 6 months. You know, obviously her father's here with her, left her on her own, but she's here with her father and the childminder, and you feel this wrench. But then as soon as I was in LA doing the interviews, you know, I was covering the Oscars, you're just in the moment, and you can appreciate the times when you can work, you know, past the 6 o'clock deadline. You know, you're not tied to the meal times and the schedule. Mm-hmm. And then you come back and you're back with them and you enjoy them. But it's also, I mean, I find it hard talking about motherhood and work and all that because, you know, we're all sensitive. And I think when people talk about their individual experiences, you know, it's easy to take that, you know, someone can hear that and think I'm saying that about all women and all mothers.
No, this
is
very much your own thing.
And it's hard. I mean, because we all do. We all look to other women to see how to do it right.
Absolutely.
And when a woman is talking about her experience with motherhood and work, then you think she's saying I'm doing it wrong. It's you know, all mothers are different. All women are different. And everybody's experience is very individual.
Absolutely. No. And actually, I think, you know, possibly as well, the thing you said about feeling like you only really started to grow up in your sort of late 30s might actually be more to do with the fact that if you find your first real success in 2000 when you're writing at The Guardian, things tend to crystallise a little bit at the time when things take off, and it's actually quite hard to evolve those things sometimes, actually. And I feel like I'm only just... that's what I love about getting older, actually, is I am thinking, starting to see myself in a different way and capable of different things. Whereas for a long time, particularly in the music world as well, you're allowed to just, like, you could stay 18 forever if you want to. There's, like, literally loads of people out there doing that. Nothing's going to force your hand. And it's not even necessarily motherhood that does that. I mean, obviously, motherhood might be the first time you've felt like you've had to be responsible for someone else. But you can still be really quite selfish within that, be, you know, going to your day job and going back into that time warp of yourself.
Totally.
So there's lots of, we're way more complicated than that.
No, and I mean, you were so successful when you were so young when you became so successful. And certainly when I interview people who've had, you know, that kind of success, it's funny how there's often this arrested development.
Definitely.
I mean, for me, I don't feel like I was very successful in the 2000s, if I'm honest. I think what kind of, you know, stopped me from growing is that I was anorexic as a teenager, and that does kind of stop you in some ways. Like, it is a way of stopping growing up in a lot of ways. And I still feel sometimes like a decade behind. Like, there's a part of me that feels kind of in my early 30s. I'm very much not, I'm in my early 40s. And I always feel slightly like a decade behind. When I went to university, I still felt barely like 13, really. I felt so young. I still treated it like school. Then in my 20s, I kind of treated that time as university. I was suddenly, like, you know, taking drugs or going out. Like, that was my university time.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm always slightly behind. So when I say I didn't grow up till my late 30s with the kids, I mean, that's basically saying I didn't grow up till I was 28 in my mind, when actually I was 38.
Yes. But then, I suppose, I mean, we're the same age pretty much. I think for our generation, maybe the big markers aren't the same anyway. I mean, I mean, you just touched there on anorexia as a teenager, which must be massively significant. But even without something like that, I have so many people, and I know for me as well, that didn't really, they reached all sorts of anxieties when they sort of came out the other side of uni. Or, I mean, for me, it was like definitely my early 20s where I suddenly thought everything's kind of been planned up to now, and now I actually don't know what the plan is.
Yeah.
But I don't, you probably know this already, but I actually only just recently learned this, but when you become pregnant and have a baby, the parts of your brain that control your anxiety, that actually enlarges. So it's social interaction and empathy and anxiety that are primarily affected with oxytocin, which I had no clue.
Yeah, I didn't know.
But it makes a lot of sense, and I kind of wish I'd known before.
Yeah, right.
But apparently when you have a baby, it's the first time you've really had to worry about things quite a lot that you can't actually control.
So true.
And if you're someone that's struggled with aspects of that before, that must be a really big deal to be changing. So I think, I mean, from what I'm hearing, I know for you, you feel like you're still growing up and all these things, and, you know, a state of, you know, feeling like 10 years behind. But I think you must be an incredibly strong person to have gone through all that and then had babies and had to go through that feeling of being out of control again. That's a big deal.
And don't you feel like, as well, I mean, I certainly had this when the twins were born. I would just be up at night, like, full of anxiety, imagining things happening to them. And I didn't realize everybody was like that. I thought I was just this lunatic, and I'd have these awful fantasies in my head of, like, well, because I'm also epileptic, which just kind of added a whole different level of anxiety. And I'd have these whole imagined scenarios in my head of, like, me having a seizure on the street and, like, letting go of the pram and the pram rolling into the street. Like, and fully imagined stories. And it was only eventually, like, after 2 or 3 years when I sort of started mentioning these to friends, I thought, oh, actually, this is everyone. It's not me being this mental head case, which is how I always think of myself.
No.
It is actually everybody who thinks this, and worrying about this so much when you're on a work trip, and then everyone's saying, you see, she was on a work trip and something happened to the kids, and da 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 da. And actually, it's everybody. It's not just me being
a lunatic. I think of things almost like I imagine, like, the newspaper article.
Oh, gosh.
What happened. Like, and I think, you know, so one, things are happening. I'm like, would I be okay about this if this is how they summarized it? And if I'm totally honest, I quite often, more often than I'd like, wake up in the morning and think, is this the day something really awful happens with the kids?
I know.
And it's like, it's a, I think you everybody has those avenues, as you say, and part of it's nature is doing it deliberately because, you know, we're supposed to be responsible for these small people who've got, you know, little to no common sense. So, you know, you need to be thinking about that. But sometimes, I mean, I'll have it while I'll be lying in bed at night and my brain will go through a series of these awful accidents.
Oh, that's so terrible.
You're like, oh, stop it. And we've all got things that are our particular Achilles heel with that, I think. Like for me, it's bodies of water. I was freak out about swimming
really?
Pools and water.
Yeah.
I think at the time he was four, my eldest, he'd gone, we were staying with friends, house, classic thing, and he'd gone to find his dad and actually decided to go swimming. And he was lying starfish down in the pool.
God.
And I thought, that's it, he's dead.
Oh my God.
So I ran as far as I could and he sort of popped up when I got within about 10 metres and went, oh, mummy, I was just, you know, holding my breath. And,
oh my God.
And then the adrenaline kicked in and I was shaking like a leaf. And I think
God.
That's, yeah.
You must have had such post-traumatic stress disorder afterwards or whatever it is. Like,
yeah.
You must have been like, how did you sleep that night afterwards?
Yeah, I just remember being in a blur and just, going over and over and over it.
Oh my God. I mean, last weekend I went away for the weekend for a friend's 40th abroad somewhere. And this weekend had been planned for ages because when the baby was 2 months old, my husband had to go away for 2 months for work. So it was always this thing like when he got back, I could have this week, you know, have some time away, you know, I could have some time of my own. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go to this 40th birthday. And then as the plane was taking off, I suddenly thought, what if something happens? And everyone's like, see, the mother was in this plane crash. She'd left her three children behind while she could go off and party. And I could just imagine this horrible Daily Mail. I thought, obviously, everything's fine. I got back. Just, you know, spoiler alert there. But you do. You just picture all these stories just happening.
Yeah.
And it's a way of judging yourself as well.
I was gonna
you
say,
being slack. You know, how dare you take time off? How dare you
thing.
Work? So
yeah, but I mean, how do we move on from that? Because that's quite tough. That's quite a tough voice.
It is. I mean, for me, like my sister and I both work and we're both mothers of three. And our mother was wonderful, but she gave up her job when we were born. And I think we saw that she got quite bored a little bit when we were in our teens and didn't need her as much. And we were going out of the house much more. And I think that just really inspired us to want to work. I mean, my sister works way harder than me. She's an A&E doctor at John Radcliffe in Oxford.
Oh, so wow, she's got a proper job.
She's got a proper job where she has to leave the house at 6 a.m. every day. And there'll be like 3 days in a row when she doesn't see her kids. Whereas like, I just sit upstairs on my ass all day long. But for both of us, that's always been the motivation. Of we don't want that. And, you know, and it wasn't like my sister and I felt guilty about our mother, but, you know, we were always aware that, you know, that she's so smart, my mom, she got like summa cum laude at university, that there was always more she could have done. And I think we both wanted to do that and to show our children that as well.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you about, if you were raised by sort of working parents, but presumably your dad was working
all the time.
My
dad, so he worked on Wall Street when we lived in New York, and then we came here and he became a diplomat. And so he was away for like long stretches.
Okay.
He could be away for like 10 days at a time or whatever. And so our mom looked after us, and it was wonderful. It was, you know, it was wonderful coming home every day and our mom was there and she would have snacks ready for us. Like I am aware of all that, you know, that it's the nanny who picks the kids up. I do know that. But I also know that was a job that had a limit for my mother. And then she didn't go on. Well, actually, I say she didn't go on to anything else. She did. She went to my school and got classics A level and then went to King's College and went and got a classics degree.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So she did go off and find her own things. But my sister and I just knew we wanted to work. And that's what we did.
Well, I'm very impressed with your sister working those long hours because, like, as a musician, we tend to complain if we've got like 3 days in a row of any sort of work.
I mean, my sister went through medical school. She went to Imperial late. She was a photographer at The Guardian for a while, and then she decided to be a doctor. And she went through two pregnancies while at medical school. I mean, my sister's kind of insane.
Wow.
And she's now an A&E doctor at John Radcliffe. I mean, before that, she was working in HIV hospitals in Jamaica, and I would go visit her. And I mean, she works way harder than me, and she had kids younger than me. So she's been in this game a lot longer.
And does she deal with the guilt and the judgment in the same way to you, or are you quite different like that, do you think?
She does, and she also has less childcare, so she does a lot more juggling. She does, but she's also much more pragmatic in a lot of ways. I mean, I'm quite pragmatic too. I don't have guilt about, you know, my kids having a childmind or a nanny or anything like that. But I feel bad when they miss me, when they want to be with me. That's the thing. And so does my sister.
But I suppose as well, just to sort of play devil's advocate a little bit, if you're doing a job like literally saving people's lives, you can be quite pragmatic because you know that where you go, you're needed and you've trained and you've done all that work. So there's been a trajectory, there's a shape to it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're creative, And you've always loved writing, and presumably writing's always been somewhere you've gone to throughout your whole life as a place where you feel like, this is somewhere where I kind of know where I'm at.
Mm.
It's actually quite hard to always give yourself that rightful place.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
You've sort of had to carve it into being all the other things you're doing and raising your family, but it's quite hard to shape that sometimes, because if you don't go to your computer for a day, no one's going to die. I love your writing.
Exactly. I mean, no one cares if this, I mean, you know, I write a book, great, but the world's not going to collapse if I don't write a book. And it's also things like, you know, with The Guardian, I get to do fun stuff. I'm not one of their hard-hitting investigative reporters. And you think, I'm going away for a week to cover the Oscars, like to interview Corey Feldman. Like, can I justify leaving my three children to do this stuff? And of course, it is fun. And, you know, my editors want it and I love doing it, but it's not a life or death situation.
But the world still needs that thing, because you can't have it can't be all the serious stuff, you know?
That's what I hope.
You know, it's definitely true. It's definitely true. You know, last week I was rereading your book, Life Moves Pretty Fast, and it was making me laugh out loud. And that is actually a really precious thing as well, you know? It's really important, that stuff. Plus, when you read a book like that, and, you know, as I say, the same generation as you, that having that sort of nice, warm feeling of what resonated with you when you were growing up helps you actually kind of remember the core of who you are. It actually provides a proper job to how you feel about yourself. And, you know, it was really nice just to spend some time thinking, like, way longer about Ghostbusters than I had for a really long time. And about Steve Guttenberg.
Lovely Steve Guttenberg.
I loved it when he said something like, his performance in one of the films made you think he could maybe actually really be an actor one day.
I know.
Really brought me up.
I know. He's one of the few people who's refused to give me an interview. I feel very sad about Steve Guttenberg.
No.
He would only do it over the phone. He wouldn't do it face-to-face. And I don't do phone or interviews, which makes me think maybe there's something like with his face. I don't know. Oh. It was something very strange. But yeah, I've always been sad not to interview one of my great acting heroes, Steve Guttenberg.
Who have you interviewed from Ghostbusters?
Interviewed almost all of them now, actually.
Really?
Yeah, the one I missed, well, that's actually totally untrue. I just interviewed Bill Murray and Rick Moranis, another acting hero, Robert Zemeckis, who's the director, and Bob Gale. Bob Gale was involved in Back to the Future. Zemeckis and Gale, sorry. Zemeckis and Gale were Back to the Future. Ivan Reitman is Ghostbusters. I've interviewed Ivan Reitman a couple of times. But Aykroyd, never, and I missed Harold Ramis, which is very sad to me. The rest of them I have gotten. I've interviewed, I think, everybody now from Back to the Future.
Really?
Which I take enormous pride in.
That is really good.
I think every single person, writer, director, producer, all the stars, like literally every single one of them.
It's a great movie, Back to the Future.
It's like the best movie ever.
It is. Have your boys seen it yet?
Not
they're
yet.
Little,
they're
but...
still a bit too young, so they're four. I mean, their favorite movie at the moment is Muppet Christmas Carol.
Good one.
Which is a classic.
Are they watching it even now?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We watched it the other night. I mean, they've got no sense of like, they're like, it's winter. Yes, that is fair enough. But I can't wait to start them on like Indiana Jones, Back to the Future, you know, all that kind of stuff. I just love
so
much.
So many good movies. Actually, my four-year-old, Jesse, he started watching Little Bits and Bobs. So he's he hasn't seen Back to the Future, but he's seen E.T. And The Wizard of Oz, and he said,
The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he said, these are special films.
They are.
And I thought, that's
films.
Interesting. It's something in there. I mean, I think E.T. as well. Like, what an amazing bit of storytelling.
I know. My boys were a bit scared by it. I tried to show them
really?
Over Christmas. They found E.T. himself a little scary. Like, especially when he's in the closet.
How he looks. Yeah,
how he looks. And when Drew Barrymore finds him in the closet, they found that slightly scary. I think they're probably, you know, a few months older now, so we'll try. But I've got to ask you, Sophie. I mean, I confuse my children's names 20 times a day. How do you not confuse your
kids? No, I do. I literally have to run through them all the time. Apparently, there's a reason for that. Apparently, it's to do with where in your brain you sort of, it's almost like a file in your head.
Yeah, right.
People that give you the same emotional feeling are the same. That's why it is always like a little bit of a revealing thing if you swap names, actually, because you're sort of storing them potentially in the same sort of feeling about someone.
God, I often call them by the dog's name sometimes.
Yeah, but that's because you love your dog.
So bad.
You love your dog and you have to look after your dog.
I mean, the dog was here before the husband, so I call him
really?
The original gangster. I mean, he is the OG of the house.
Oh, that's so sweet, though. That's Arthur, isn't it, dog?
Arthur, named after B. Arthur, who is...
Oh, really?
My
golden girl.
Yeah, ultimate. And actually, the baby, I mean, I probably shouldn't give away the baby's name, but she is named after another Golden Girls actress.
Really?
I want to have the full collection of the Golden Girls at some point. It's my favorite TV show of all time.
I've been to a Golden Girls themed birthday party.
Oh, it's the greatest. It's the most important. It was
really
written
fun.
By the guy who wrote Arrested Development.
Really? Really?
Yeah. So when he came over to promote the fourth series or whatever it was, I begged to interview him just to talk about Golden Girls. And I arrived and everybody else was talking to him, obviously, about, you know, Jason Bateman and, you know, the Bluth family and all that. And I just had 100 questions about Golden Girls.
Yeah,
like, who is this lunatic? All I wanted to do was talk about Blanche and Dorothy and Rose and all the rest of that.
Well, those are all good names, actually.
Great names.
Yeah.
So, because I thought I was getting a girl dog. I got Arthur the dog when I lived in New York. So that was like 10 years ago. And I was supposed to get the girl dog. So I was going to call her Betty. And then in the end, the breeder decided to keep her to do something. And Arthur was the runt of the litter. And she was going to give him away. And I said, actually, I could do a B. Arthur situation here. So Arthur came.
It might have been the runt of the litter, but actually, I'd say a fairly dominant golden girl.
So you've raised
Arthur.
He is more dominant than B. Arthur was, as you found out when you rang the doorbell, and he scared the living crap out of you, probably.
Oh, no. I was impressed, not scared. It's good. So with the book you've just written, you've touched a little bit on how long it's taken you to write that. That must have been like a labor of love, really.
Yeah, I know. Someone said that to me when I was working on it. I really bristled because that made it sound like a hobby. And now that I've done it, I'm like, yes, it absolutely was a labor of love. And also, while I was doing it, I wrote other books. So I did like Life Moves Pretty Fast because I found it so heavy going. I mean, there's only so much time you can spend in like the Auschwitz archives before you're like, you know what? I need to write about Back to the Future for a bit. And the thing is, the book is actually not that depressing. And World War II is only a tiny bit of it. But that just required so much research. And I gave up history when I was like 15 years old, so I had to educate myself about so much, and it's quite heavy going. But the book itself is actually quite uplifting. I mean, there's only one death in it, amazingly, because it's Jewish family in the 20th century. But there were times when I thought, you know what, this is kind of too much. I just want to do a fun book. And in the end, the family book, I hope, is quite fun. But it just required wading through a lot of depressing stuff before I could get to the story.
But it's so vital that those stories are told, actually. I'd actually really like to go and visit Auschwitz. Have you been?
Yes. So my dad and I went. It was the last research trip I did for the book. So he came with me in March 2018. And it's really fascinating. I mean, obviously, it's not, you know, it's not Disneyland, but it's very subject to historical interpretation. So whereas if you went 5 years ago, the focus was very much on, you know, the 1.1 million Jews who were killed and, what was happening in Poland at the time, what was happening in Germany, you know, was there Polish collaboration, et cetera, et cetera. Now there's a very far-right party called the Law and Justice Party in power, and it's totally different. You go to Auschwitz now, if you go on the official tour, the focus is entirely on the Polish dissidents who were killed. So 70,000 Polish dissidents were killed. And that's what you get. And a lot of the Polish ministers in charge at the moment will say things like, we don't want this focus on what they call foreign narratives, which is what they mean, Jewish stories. And various people who work at Auschwitz have had swastikas painted on their house because some people in Poland feel that there's too much emphasis placed on the Jews. There's too much emphasis placed on Polish collaboration, Polish culpability. So there's now a focus really on Poland, this noble victim, and the Jews are kind of a side dish. And the weirdest thing about it, when you go to Auschwitz, is that there's a gift shop in the car park. Which is so hilarious. Because, obviously the thing you want when you go to Auschwitz is an I Heart Poland mug.
I went to Auschwitz and all I got was this lousy T-shirt.
Exactly. I mean, it's basically that. And when I went in 2018, I then came back and wrote a column about it for the Guardian magazine, and Auschwitz got in touch with me on Twitter, reprimanding me about this gift shop. And I sent them back the photos. I was like, here is the gift shop. And they said, it's run by the local municipality. It's not run by us. And I was like, that's not any better, guys. It's not good that the local government has set up a gift shop in your car park. But I just thought, honestly, all the things that Auschwitz has done to my family over the years, now I'm getting reprimanded on Twitter by it. Give us a break, guys. I just thought, this has to be some great Jewish joke being told off by Auschwitz on Twitter.
Yeah, that's all pretty extraordinary. And I just came back from Israel. I went for the first time the other day, and we did a day trip to Jerusalem. We didn't. I was supposed to be going for work, and we had two flights, so I just went with Richard, actually.
Right.
And there's lots of street vendors there in Jerusalem, and you can buy a crown of thorns to take home if you wanted to.
great present for the kids.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll take five.
It's so weird.
We're at for World Book Day.
Oh my God, that'd be incredible. I mean, the merching of these sites is always so fascinating. I mean, whether it's Auschwitz or Israel or whatever, and just, I mean, people need the money, sure, but like selling crowns of thorns is something else.
I know. I suppose then when you're there, you have to sort of find the bit of it that resonates, that means something to you,
don't you?
You have to find your own little experience a bit off the beaten track. But yeah, I suppose it's probably always been the case.
For sure.
It always seems very uncomfortable.
Oh, it's so weird.
Bedfellows. But yeah, the gift shop in Auschwitz is definitely a new one.
It's such a great Jewish joke. You know, Auschwitz has a gift shop.
But I mean, with the book... I suppose your little boys being four, they're probably too little to really know what you do for a living.
Well, they know that mummy and daddy work for a newspaper. I mean, my partner, is also at The Guardian, because they see our photos in the paper occasionally. Okay. And they now know that mummy's written a book about Grandpa Ron's mummy, is how they take it. And there are photos, there's a few photos of me when I was a little girl at the end. So they see those, and they see photos of their grandfather in the book.
Yeah.
But they have no sense, really, of what it is we do all day. And I mean, I had to explain it to them basically that work is like school. And they were like, why are you always working? Why is mommy always working? I was like, it's like being at school, sweetie. This is what grown-ups do. But no, they have no idea. They have no concept that other parents do different things. I mean, Andy is a sports writer, so he's often working on the weekends. You know, he'll be away for a month this summer because of the Olympics, if it's not canceled. He was away for 2 months earlier this year for the Rugby World Cup. And to them, this is just the norm, as it must be for your kids, that, you know, mummy goes away to make music.
Exactly, yeah. It does take a little while for them to get to the age where world factor. I mean, for me, with my mum, when I was little, she was presenting... a children's TV thing with Peter.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So I think I was about six or seven, when I realised, oh, hang on, not everybody else's mum is going off and doing this.
It's on TV.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
But the different thing about what you do for a living that is quite unique, I think, is that you'll be able to share that book with them. I mean, obviously the other books too, but a book about their family and their history.
I know, but do you think they'll ever want to read it? I mean, do people want to read what their parents do? I sort of wonder if that's just like...
Not when they're teenagers, but... Yeah. But definitely one day.
I hope so. And it is their story. And it felt also important to do it because Andy's not Jewish. And I want them to have a real sense of their Jewish heritage, the background. They're going to start Hebrew school in September, so they'll have that.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm the one who's going to have to schlep them there. There's no way Andy's going to like take them on Sunday mornings to Hebrew school. But I want them to know their background, you know, what people went through in order to ensure their survival, as the cliche goes.
Yeah.
So yeah, that also, maybe that was also another motivating factor in writing it once they came along, is I want my children to have a sense of their Jewish background.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, I think, you know, it's like so, everybody is so influenced by their upbringing and their family. But if you have got history and religion and cultural things and tradition like that, it's like you're saying, it's even like the thing with work, you know, with what you do for a living. It'll be when they get a bit older, they'll think, oh, hang on a minute, not everybody goes to Hebrew school or whatever. They'll start being informed. And then, you know, they might think, oh, actually, that's really interesting because that's made me, you know, influence that aspect of my life. I think it's really good to have such a strong sense of where you come from, I think. And not everybody has that.
Do your kids listen to their parents' music?
Well, with Richard's music, it's a little bit harder for them to get away from it, because Richard will suddenly decide he needs to listen to a mix of something and put it on really loud, even if Mickey's just gone down for a nap. And he's a lot more, I think maybe because he's the bass player, he's a lot more happy to be playing stuff. And if people come around, he'd be like, listen to this new thing I've just done. Whereas for me, I'm a lot shyer about playing my stuff, so I'll do it sometimes, but no, I don't listen to myself like just for the pleasure of it. I'm writing a new album at the moment, sometimes I'll listen to the demos and just check things, but I'm just as happy to play things through my phone. I sometimes can't be bothered to like rig it all up to proper speakers. And with my gigs, the last few gigs I've done in London, I'll say to them, who wants to come? And like last time, like one person put their hand up, so that was Ray. He's 7. He's very sweet. I think he's realized that because children, I think, are very clever at finding, I don't know why I've always thought of it as like the weakness and the damn, but I think they'll think, well, that character's, you know, that brother's doing that, that kid's doing that, I'm going to do that once. And so being a sort of someone nice enough to come to my gigs was a slot available for Ray. he'll probably grow out of it. But he was sat there and it was really adorable. But I think for the most part, they get quite bored by my gigs. And I know when I used to take them to festivals all the time when they were little, like Sunny saying to me afterwards, you should have had a climbing frame for the people when they got bored watching. So that's about the level of it, really.
And are your studios in the house? So
we have got a studio at home, but I don't really use it. That's what Richard uses. I like to go to work, to be honest. That's why I was asking you so much about working from home, because I really struggle. And plus, I don't think I've been very smart at how I've set up my work in their eyes, and that because I adore it and I've done the same thing since I was a teenager pretty much, I don't think I've told them enough about how I actually do still need to work because I'm earning a living as well. And I think I've made them feel like it's sort of optional. A bit like with your son saying, you know, but do you have to go? Just don't go. they're a bit like that about me with pretty much everything. So I'm trying, I feel like I'm only just now getting old enough to be like, a bit more unapologetic about my boundaries for what I'm doing and how important it is for me.
Yeah. I mean, I would just say to them now, when they say, why do you have to go to work? Why do you have to go away? I say it so I can buy you snacks and books.
Yeah.
And I say, because this is how it works. You know, I work, they give me money, I use the money then to buy you things.
Exactly.
And then they sort of get it.
Yeah. I mean, they're still little as well. I have to say, I don't know, hopefully it won't be too like scary a prospect, but I find it gets harder when they get older.
I'm sure. No, everyone says that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm totally terrified of the teenage years. But once they're older and they understand more and they see other mothers not traveling so much or whatever, then that's when they're going to have some stuff to say.
Exactly.
I mean, this time, particularly in January, I was so dreading leaving the baby, but actually, of course, it was the boys who were expressing more, you know, separation
baby.
Anxiety. I mean, they didn't
You're
even
gone,
notice.
Like, fine.
Bye, off you go.
Yeah.
Whereas it was the boys who would like be saying on FaceTime every night, when are you home? Why aren't you here? I wanted you here last night. Da, da, da. And that's the killer.
Really hard.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And what was it like when you had the twins? So you said you took 4 months off.
Yeah, it was about 4 months, 4 or 5 months. Yeah, 4 months off. Yeah.
And how did you feel about the prospect of having babies?
So it wasn't IVF or anything. So it was completely unexpected. And I went in for the scan at 6 weeks or whatever it was, and the doctor said, so it's two. And I said, two arms, two legs. And he said, it's two babies. And I burst into tears, and Andy started laughing, and it was so overwhelming. And then you just kind of like put your head down and get on with it and don't think about it. And it was only since having the one baby this time that I realized it was really hard, actually. And I really didn't appreciate how much harder it was having twins. I mean, I couldn't leave the house for 2.5 months because of just, it took so long to feed them, and then there'd be a nap, and the pram was so big, and it just was a nightmare. Whereas with Betty, oh, so sorry.
No,
sorry.
We can see, I like being able to hear your cake, actually. It's making me feel like I'm at home.
With Betty, I mean, aside from the fact I was doing all my edits, I could just put her in a sling and walk out and go to Southpaw Coffee Shop or whatever, or even go to, you know, the Tate Modern or something. I could actually leave the house. And with the twins, it was really about managing. And with this with the baby, it's been about enjoying, which has been really nice.
Yeah, because I think, as well, there's a lot of people, I mean, I say this as I've got a brother and sister that are twins. I'm actually 19 years older than them. So this is my dad and my stepmom. Mm. And so I know how people, when they kind of, you know, hear you having twins and they kind of go, oh, and they laugh, like, oh, you're, you know, whoa, here we go. And, you know, you're thinking, well, it's just still my first babies and I'm really excited. And so you probably feel like, and then they come and you think, actually, this is really hard. And everybody with their first baby, I'm pretty sure, finds it quite isolating.
Absolutely.
I know I did. And so, yeah, I think you probably now can realise a bit more that actually having two babies, yes, it's really hard work, but then when they get older...
Oh, it's
how adorable
great.
Is that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think with twins is like the first 2 years is really hard and, you know, much, much harder than one baby. I can now see that. Mm. And then after two, it's actually becomes much easier because they play together. And, you know, if we hadn't had another baby, our lives would be actually super easy now. Like, the twins will happily play in their bedroom till like 9 o'clock in the morning. Like, we wouldn't be able to have a lie-in if I didn't have this 8-month-old screaming at 5 a.m. And when we go on holiday, like, you know, we've only really been on 2 holidays as a family because, as you know, it's quite hard traveling with multiple children.
Yeah.
But now, like, I see they play together, whereas I've got a lot of friends who have one child. And when they have one child, they're always on the ground playing with that child because obviously the child needs entertainment. Whereas I feel like we now have it easy. If we go to a friend's house for Sunday lunch, the twins will just go off in a corner and play together.
Yeah.
Like, that, they really do entertain each other. But the first 2 years, it was definitely hellish. And I remember, like, the first 3 months would be, like, one of them wouldn't go to sleep before 2 a.m, ever. And then I would feed at 3 a.m, and then the other one wouldn't go back to sleep.
Oh.
And it was just absolutely...
Was this happening when you were writing your columns and all this?
No, so this was when I was off work. And then in the end, we got a twin sleep trainer in, who was the absolute savior. And everyone's like, oh my God, that sounds so cruel or whatever. It really wasn't like that. It was, she would just sit in the room with them, and when one of them cried, she would just pat them slowly until they went back to sleep. And it got them both sleeping. It synced up their sleeping, which is what I really needed. And it's got them sleeping 12 hours a night, which was an absolute miracle.
Wow.
But the irony is I haven't really bothered with any of this sleep training stuff or anything with the baby, because I'm like, it's just one baby, it's fine. And as a result, she still can't sleep through the night at 8 months. So I'm actually getting less sleep than I did with the twins. But it's fine. I mean, when she wakes up crying in the night, it's not that panic I had with the twins. But if one would wake up crying, I'd be like, don't wake up the other one, don't wake up the other one. Whereas this one, she wakes up, it's like, it's fine, here's your dummy, here's some milk, here's whatever, it's fine. It's much more contained.
Yeah, and also I think you know that they will grow out of it probably quite quickly. And if you're chilled about it, it happens. I mean, yeah, Mickey, my youngest, he only really started sleeping properly probably about a month ago.
Right, yeah.
it's really recent.
Yeah.
And it, you forget how nice it is to, I say that, he woke up last night, but generally
he's
good.
Yeah,
sure. And how nice it is to go to bed and think, I probably won't see any small people till, seven. That's actually like, whoa.
Oh my God.
So exciting.
There was this period when Andy was away in Japan in October, November, and the baby was waking up like 3 times a night, and I was trying to get the basically trying to, whatever it is, train the boys not to wet the bed during the night. And there would be like one night when it'd be like, she would cry 3 times a night. One of the boys would wet the bed, then the other one would wet the bed. And it was just like absolute chaos at 4 o'clock in the morning. And you do know once you're past the first baby, these are all just phases.
Yes.
And you can just take a much bigger perspective. Whereas the first time around, you're like, this is my life forever. It's definitely not. Everything's a phase.
Yeah. And actually, it's very unusual to have a household where everybody just like gets into bed at the same time every night.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, that's definitely in my lot as well. They're getting more and more into, they'll all start off kind of quite good. And then they get to about 3 or 4 and they think, hang on a minute, I don't have to stay here. I can go and I'm hungry or my tummy hurts or, you know, I'm hot or whatever it might be. So yeah, that's like an ongoing thing. And I guess it's a bit of time, extra time they can have with you as well. well. So
I know.
It's experimenting with their power.
It's true. I mean, to be honest, I didn't really want to sleep train the baby. I mean, this makes me sound so hippie and woo-woo and all the rest of it, and I'm really not like that. But when she wakes up at 3 or 5 in the morning, I think, well, that's the little time I get to have with her. Exactly. And I bring her into bed with me, and she's so cute and warm and cuddly, and I actually don't mind, to be honest.
Oh, I just saw your baby. I would totally, yeah. she's someone I wouldn't mind seeing at 3 or 4 in the morning. She's very sweet. And what's it like for, if you're writing, what's it like when you haven't slept properly? Oh. My vocabulary sort of goes to about a quarter. It's not brilliant in the first place.
No, I mean, it's funny. I do a column in the Saturday magazine. I have to file it on Monday morning. So I actually just did it. And because I had a really bad night's sleep the night before, I've just done a column on sleeplessness for this week. Someone's just coming to say hello there.
Small. Didn't look very interested by
you. Mom, just talking.
They're just chatting away.
Boring. No biscuits, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. There's no snacks out.
I mean, you know what it's like. I mean, you've got 5. I mean, if you have to do it, you just do it. Yeah. I mean, it's how I feel like when people would say, God, twins, how do you cope? You're like, well, what am I supposed to do? Leave them in the road? I mean, you just kind of do it. And there have definitely been times when I've had to write an article or do an interview and I've had like 3 hours sleep. And you just think, I'm never going to be able to do it. But you do it. You do. I mean, I'm sure I'm giving myself premature Alzheimer's or whatever and destroying my brain. But you just kind of carry on. It sounds terrible, but you do. And I remember before I had kids, I thought, if I have less than 7 hours sleep, I'm basically a wreck. And now I just like laugh hilariously at myself in the past. I mean, I have done interviews on 2 hours sleep, and you can. I mean, it's terrible. I'm sure it's not good for you, but you can.
No, I know. And also, I think if you have work like that, sometimes you think, okay, I can just get the focus for that period of time.
Exactly. Yeah. And then die afterwards.
Exactly. No, very much so. I think it's very impressive, and I've given House of Glass to my mum to read first, but she's going to give it to me next.
Well, I have many, many spare copies in this house.
No, I have my own, and that's lovely. But I'm also telling Richard he's got to read The Life Moves Pretty Fast, because honestly, I found it so heartwarming. I was thinking actually on the way here, if there's much depiction of motherhood. I know there's parents in those movies, but there's not really many films I feel like that are about raising kids. I suppose maybe Three Men and a Little Lady is the only one I can think of.
Yeah,
Three Men and a Baby.
So it's often about dads raising kids. So
it's true.
Yeah, so you get movies like Mr. Mom with Michael Keaton and stuff. So it was the 80s, this really interesting period where there was this backlash against feminism. So what you get a lot of is this fear of the feminization of men. And because also women were in the workplace then. So obviously a lot of women going out to work, and then there was this fear of like, how is this going to affect the family, how is this going to affect men? And so what you get is repeatedly men being quite useless, having to raise kids and sort of screwing up. And you often get a lot of mothers being away and therefore the kids causing havoc in the house. So there's a lot of things like risky business or weird science and that whole kind of thing. You know, the thing that was kind of riffed on in the Yellow Pages advert about needing the French polishers. So the parents go away, the kids trash the house. So there's a lot about that. There's a lot of ideas of absent mothers and feminized fathers. There's definitely nothing that praises mothers. And one of my favorite movies, well, probably my favorite movie, is Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And the thing that's really interesting in that movie to me now as a mother is, so you have the two parents of Ferris, and they both work. The mother's an estate agent. The father works in some unexplained office in Chicago. But it's the mother who keeps getting rung up and told off by the headmaster for Ferris being away. Meanwhile, the dad's in Chicago going out to these fancy lunches in French restaurants and like watching parades out the window and flirting with sexy women in taxi cabs. But the mom is working too, but she's still having to be a mom.
Yeah.
Like that's really the message is like, and it's also not an untrue message, but it's like, okay, mothers, you can work, but it's not going to be fun for you, whereas the dad still gets to have fancy business lunches.
Yeah, that's really true, actually. I didn't think of it like that, but you're right. It is the mum that always gets the phone calls.
Oh, yeah, always. And it is still. I mean, like, if one of my boys is sick from the nursery, Andy and I, we both work from home. We are both Guardian columnists, but it's me who always gets called up about stuff.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious to me. It feels still so retrograde.
No, I think there's a lot of stuff that has really stuck in that sort of traditional roles, and I think that's partly why, because when I've first thought about the subject of like working mothers, I was like, well, maybe it's not a thing anymore. Maybe there's not really that much to discuss. And I thought, no, actually, because for better or worse, I think of myself as a very modern thinker, but I have still got myself in really quite a traditional role at home. And, you know, it's on the way here, I messaged the school about something that I remembered about. And, you know, Richard's gone off to work. And it wouldn't occur to him that he needs to phone the school to mention that one of the kids has got a play date after school, you know. And I've taken that on, and that's fine. I mean, it's not to say he couldn't do it. Of course he could do it. But I just removed that responsibility from him and thought, no, it's fine. I'll
I do it.
Keep all those things going.
No, I'm definitely the one who does the play dates. I know all the names of all the kids in their class. Yeah. I know the parents. You know, I organize the birthday parties. I mean, Andy is very hands-on. He does all the cooking in the house. He does all the food shopping. I mean, you know, he's very much a hands-on dad. His mom worked. His mom was a headmistress of local school. But I still do all that stuff. I'm the one who gets their, you know, gym kit sorted and all that. And we have literally the same job. And yet it's still me who does all that kind of pastoral care.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And if I don't know, the other day our nanny wasn't very well. And so it's well,
falls on
me
you.
That's him there.
Yeah,
it's fine.
It falls on you.
Yeah, it's funny. I sort of, I don't really know why I've ended up being quite so traditional. I didn't really, I mean, it doesn't matter. Rich is a great dad. And actually, in some ways, I think I prefer knowing all those things.
I'm quite a control freak.
I don't think I'd be very good at handing over the reins. But then sometimes I'm like, this is actually really silly.
I know. I mean, I kind of thought that with the nights with the baby. I mean, Andy hasn't really done that many nights. It's normally me. Mm. But at the same time, I would feel terrible if I was downstairs and he was in the baby's nursery. Like, I want to be with her, to be honest. And I also do like knowing all the kids' friends. But at the same time, you can recognize that you partially chose this and at the same time still furiously resent it.
Yeah.
I mean, I would never go away for 2 months from the kids the way Andy did. I would, when the twins were born, he then went away for a month for the Rio Olympics and stuff. And he doesn't have that same kind. I mean, he obviously misses them and, you know, he makes sure to leave letters. He leaves letters for them and cards for them to read while he's away and all that kind of stuff. But it wouldn't occur to me to do that. Whereas it is different. It still is. I don't know if it's a biological thing or whatever, if that's just an excuse. But, like, I was away for a week and it was really weird. It was really weird.
Yeah, and also when I go to work, I'm the one who gets the questions about who's looking after the kids while I'm away.
Yeah, always.
Yeah, exactly.
And everyone's like, how did you write a book when you had kids? I mean, Andy wrote a book when it came out right after the twins were born. Not a single person asked him about that.
No, I know. But then it's because also, especially with young children, it does seem to be still the mother's role is still that more, we're still expected to be the one that is always there and, you know, providing the really sort of basics of nurture. And that's not to say you can't reverse those roles. You can't have it any which way you want. And in fact, I've got a really good friend of mine where she goes to work, her husband does all the childcare, and she's brilliantly straight up about it. But it is in stark contrast to most stories I know.
Course.
It just isn't the norm.
And it's true. I mean, my sister gave me this book when the twins were born. I don't know if you've read this too, called Raising Boys.
Oh, I've heard. I think I've got it on a shelf somewhere.
So I think by an Australian family therapist or something. And there was a really interesting thing in the first chapter where he says from ages 0 to 6, the boys focuses all on the mum. And then from 6 to 12, it switches to the dad. And then from 12 onwards, it's kind of about breaking away from the parents a little bit. I didn't want to read that bit. That was too upsetting.
But just go back to the mum again.
Yeah, exactly. You don't live with me forever. And I thought, well, that kind of makes sense. Because it's true, the boys, like if they wake up in the night, if one of them has a bad dream or wets the bed, they do call out for me. Mm. Like the instinct is still towards me. But I see as they get older, they're having more fun with Andy. You know, he can take them to sports matches. He takes them to like Imperial War Museums and tank museums and boring heteronormative stuff. But at the same time, he'll take them, like he teaches them how to cook, and you know, it's not like he's some weird Chuck Norris masculine figure, but they are now having more fun with their dad. But it's still me they cling to for kind of emotional stuff.
Yeah, I think that is echoed in so many houses. Is that hello, Arthur?
Sorry,
you know what Arthur's come to tell me? He says you've been talking for too long.
This is another
and
little
Arthur,
creature.
You're right.
I know the endless small creatures in my house who demand attention.
Well, also I'm sort of aware of the irony of the fact I'm talking to you about being a working mum, which meant you've had to organise childcare for your 3 children downstairs, so you can talk to me.
But I have to say, Sophie, I feel like such an amateur next to you. I mean, I only have 3. You have 5 kids. I don't know how you get dressed
in the morning. Sometimes I go out in really weird outfits.
I did a bizarre
school run the other day. I looked at myself and I was like, whoa, this is really pushing me. I mean, I'm quite relaxed. I kind of think it was like, oh, God.
But how do you do the school run with 5? I mean, obviously you're not taking all 5.
No, I'm not. Well, my eldest does it by himself now. So it's, and if I, the ideal is that someone's at home to have the baby because then he doesn't have to be carted around, particularly when it's so cold. So then there's 2 at primary and then 1 at nursery. And it's actually quite straightforward. They're pretty near us and everything like that. So that's not the tricky bit. It's more, actually, I find the hardest bit is probably having such diverse ages and making sure they all feel like they get a time with me.
I know.
And I do all separate bedtimes. So I start at about 7 and I don't finish till Well, Kit's starting at about 9. He's the 11-year-old. And then I'll go and tell Sonny at about 10. But I need to spend a bit of time with him as well.
Yeah,
that's more it. So really, like, Richard's out tonight. So that's me. Like, that's three
that's
hours of
evening.
My evening. I'll try and eat in somewhere in the middle of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not going to last forever.
I know. And that's, like, I keep reminding myself, this is such a short period. Like, there's going to be a time when they don't really want to hang out with me.
No,
and right now,
no.
They're always saying, I want mummy time. And you want to have that time in the day. I mean, this is the thing I struggle with most probably as a working mother, or maybe it's just as a mother, is that you don't just want to be managing things and being like,
no.
You know, get up, get dressed, go to school, brush your teeth. You want to be enjoying things, you know, and having this one-on-one connection with them. And that's the thing that's hard. Really.
I agree. And like sometimes when I go away to work and people say, the kids are fine, I go, I'm not worried about the kids. It's me. I'm the one who's feeling sad that I'm not there.
I know.
So no, I think that's really true. And but sometimes you are just getting by. And actually, you know, I've spoken to my mum about this, and, you know, she was saying about when I was small and she was a single mum for a while, she said, I was really selfish. I was going out all the time. She'd just broken up with my dad, and she was like, I was, you know, dating. And, you know, but she said, if I'm honest, it wasn't the best parenting I ever did. And I said, but you know, my memory is not that.
Mm.
My memory is that I always felt loved. I always felt safe.
Mm.
And we're really close. Mm. So actually, we really have to remember that good enough is actually still good as well. And not every day is going to be this rip-roaring, you know, we baked a cake and we've just done some painting and, you know, they're all wiped out and they've just done some sport and, you know, we didn't even leave the house on Saturday and, you know, it's not ideal. I'd like it if we all went out for, like, climbing trees and things, but we didn't. We just sort of
sometimes you just need Netflix.
Exactly. To watch some 80s movies. Which is what I'm going to do tonight while Rich is out.
If you have time after your 7 to 10
I'll
stretch.
Make time. Yeah. If I'm honest, the sexiest thing was when Rich is away, I get to maybe watch a movie and do a jigsaw puzzle. So that's my night.
Oh my God.
It is heaven. I love them and love puzzles.
And also just when you can just sit and be and not speak and not have anyone asking you questions.
Exactly.
The times after I've gotten all the kids into bed and I come down and Andy will ask, like, where's something? And I'm like, I am not answering anything anymore.
I know, exactly. That'll be me tonight. And I might even get my Game Boy out for
Game Boy.
Yeah.
Now I'm super
little bit
jealous.
Tetris.
Oh my God.
I'm all rock and roll these days.
So peaceful. Oh my God, that sounds so good. Is it like an old school one?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
The original.
Where did you get it?
eBay.
Okay, I need to get I want the Super Mario Brothers on Game Boy.
Yeah, yeah.
That
that'll probably come with it.
Favorite thing ever.
But remember, you need batteries and an independent light source because it's not backlit.
Yeah.
It's probably the worst aspect of a Game Boy.
That's fine. That's oh my God, that sounds so good. It's better than a massage.
It. There you go. And when I take it, I'm back. Imagine believe the amount of people that say to me, "Where did you get that?"
Oh yeah,
it gets
my
a
God!
A lot of attention, my Game Boy.
More than the kids.
Sweet. Oh,
dog. And when I take him out to the park with the kids, it's actually the dog. I mean, it's actually the dog that gets all the attention. Everyone comes and goes, "Oh, your dog's so cute." I'm like, "And these three children?" No, it's the dog that gets the focus.
Yeah, I can see why. Well, thank you so much, Hedley.
Oh, thank you so much for coming, Sophie.
No, really. It's been really lovely to speak to you, and I'm so excited about your book.
Thank you. That's very kind of you.
Thing.
No.
And I'll continue to enjoy your stuff in The Guardian, too.
Oh, well, thank you.
Honestly, everybody I've told that I'm speaking to you is, like, such big fans. You've got a lot of people out there.
Like, Arthur's scoffing at that. No,
no.
It's
true, Arthur.
So, do you have one suggestion?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Remember the question about your pre-baby self?
Oh, yes. Okay, yeah, no, that's a good idea. I didn't
Should I get rid of him for continuity? Is that easier? Yeah, let me put him outside. Come here, mister. I could go out and play. No, definitely don't do that. It's a game that never ends. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. He is a total ball fanatic. Was there anything else I did that?
No, because I was wondering about the roles and
Okay, cool. Hadley, you mentioned when you were younger and you felt like you were sort of dicking around a lot and not. Oh, Arthur's back in. It's fine.
Sorry.
Arthur, we didn't mean to banish you. You can be here.
I'm sorry.
When you mentioned about when you were younger and you felt like you were just sort of had much more time to sort of prat about and and take your time to grow up.
Yes.
What do you think that version of you would think about you now and how you're mothering and also how your life has changed?
Yeah, that is a good question. I do think sometimes, well, what would my 18-year-old self think about my 40-year-old self? But perhaps a better question is, what would my 29-year-old self think about my 40-year-old self? I think I'd be surprised at how together I am. I mean, for a while, I just felt like I needed, you know, my own space. I needed to go off and get off my face occasionally. I needed to go off to Glastonbury and Ibiza and just stay up for 4 days at a time. And actually, I've been okay. And I can still go out and have fun. I'm not, like, staying at home all the time. I do go out to festivals still. I do go out to parties. But I'm not out getting smashed every weekend by any stretch of the imagination. And I think I'd be relieved. I mean, for a while, it did feel like, to be honest, it's particularly in my late 20s, early 30s, my life was beginning to feel a bit out of control. And it has come together, thank goodness.
But isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah.
And also to not be worrying about food all the time anymore. I mean, that I got out of hospital last time when I was 17, but I was still, like, terrified of sugar and carbohydrates and all that crap until I was probably about 31, 32. And I look at photos of myself then, I still look pretty thin. I mean, now I look, you know, probably almost, you know, I probably look a bit overweight because I haven't lost the baby weight, and I actually really don't care. And that's a huge relief, too, to, like, for that not to be an issue at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sort of trying to bite my tongue and say, well, no, of course you don't look overweight at all. But I also know it's not actually really about what I say and what I'm...
I mean, it's fine. I mean, I, you know, last time with the twins, you know, well, maybe it was still a bit with the twins. I went back into exercising right away after they were born, like six weeks. You know, I was, you know, back at the gym. And this time I haven't done anything. I just kind of don't care anymore. It's fine. I feel like it's like a skin I've slipped off in a big way.
But isn't that a powerful thing? Because I think so many people go through, I mean, a lot of people go through various issues with their mental health when they're young, teenage or in their 20s. But I think, I mean, you know, you've touched on it a little bit, but, you know, you were actually out of school for a long time and probably the idea that you would turn into such a highly functioning, successful adult, probably actually at that age, probably seemed completely insurmountable.
And also, you know, you can't really imagine yourself, you know, without that part of you. It feels so, it feels like such a strong part of your identity. You might be scared of losing it. And it just feels unimaginable to be able to, I mean, if you're anorexic in the way I was, you know, this idea that you could eat spontaneously, to think, I feel hungry, therefore I'll have a scone, and I won't then skip dinner for three nights or whatever. Like, to be able just to eat without thinking is kind of incredible. I think there is a reason that it happens mainly in adolescent years. I do think it is something that people grow out of to a certain extent. But, you know, if it's as ingrained as it was in me, you do think, this could be my life. I could just go through my life, like, never eating certain things and, you know, fearfully looking up the menus of a restaurant before going to meet a friend there and all that.
Yeah.
And to not have to do that anymore, it's just like, oh, you free up so much real estate in your brain.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Also, for the people that were worried about you and love you, that must be the thing they were always hoping for you, and you'd get to that point and... You know, it's a long journey, but it happened.
Yeah, and also I think, like, I mean, I don't know, I didn't think about it so much with the twins, which is maybe stupid, because obviously boys can get eating disorders too, but especially once I had a daughter, I was very conscious of, I do not want to pass on bad habits. I do not want her to think this is what women are like, this is how women should measure themselves and women judge themselves. So I am very conscious of not eating like that around her, not thinking like that around her, even though she's 8 months old. But, you know, you don't want to get into that pattern. I
mean, no.
And, I do stress. I do know men get eating disorders. There were men in hospital with me. But it wasn't something I thought about as much, and now I am very conscious of it.
No, I know. I can totally understand that. And I think also, you know, people are really complicated. So whilst that's how it manifested, whatever you might... I don't know if you ever really do untangle exactly what it is that kicks those things off. But actually, I think when we always worry, don't we, about what our children inherit from us that's not the size of us we're as proud of, and that's natural.
Yeah.
But from where I'm sitting, I think your kids hopefully will inherit your strength, because that's actually an incredible thing to go through and to get the other side of and to be able to reflect on. Because all those things, I bet, just didn't seem like that day would come when you're in free fall.
I mean, it was just, the idea that I'd one day have three kids and a job just feels, you know, that would have been totally foreign. But I think every family has learned ways of coping. You know, people talk about, is alcoholism genetic or any of this stuff? And maybe in some cases it is, but I think there's also people pick up ways of coping. And in my family, it was definitely always eating disorders. I've got cousins with eating disorders. My grandmother was always really, had difficult relationship with food. So I don't think it was genetic. I think we just saw how other adults coped with feelings of anxiety and feelings of, you know, wanting to express unhappiness. And the way was always through food. And that is what you don't want your children to pick up. You don't want your children to think, okay, I'm feeling really anxious, therefore I'm going to drink a lot. Or, you know, I want to have fun, therefore I need to take a lot of drugs. Or, I want to say I'm unhappy, therefore I'm going to not eat dinner. Like, you just need to teach them that you can just say things directly.
Yes, well, golly, that's a massive topic in itself, isn't it, about how we deal with things. And I think actually we are getting a lot better at, these things aren't nearly as taboo and they're a lot more open. And I think what I didn't really realise, I think, is your relationship with so many things is sort of formed pretty much by the time you're probably only about 8 to 10, actually.
I know,
you know,
it's
love,
terrifying.
Money, food, all these things, and your emotions.
Mm.
But you know, when kids get to being a teenager, firstly, you've laid a lot of the groundwork if you've given them a loving, secure home. But also, they are their own people, and
yeah.
to a certain extent, you know, we're only the mums. You know, there's so many other influences in their lives, and you know. If you're there and always open and communicative and loving, I don't think there's really much more you can offer. And
yeah.
after a while, people are going to be responsible for themselves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just
sure.
as you got yourself into such a pickle with all of that,
mm-hmm.
you got yourself out of it too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I have a sister who's only 14 months younger than me, and she didn't go through any of that.
Mm.
So, you know, as parents, we think everything is nurture, but there's a hell of a lot of nature
Absolutely.
That goes on. And as much as we think, if I do everything right, then my kids will be fine, or if
yeah.
anything goes wrong with my kids, it's my fault. But they are, like you say, their own people.
Yeah, it doesn't really exist, that,
no.
I don't think, actually.
No,
because what's the extreme of that? What, keeping them in a sort of, you know, sealed
in a little bubble?
And that's probably going to result
that's
in the most...
That's terrible, too.
The
I mean, you know, my partner and I, you know, debate this all the time. I mean, I'm all about protecting and cosseting, and he's all about, you know, experience
yeah.
and letting them feel this, you know, not, you know, it's not like he's beating them, but, you know, things like, you know, how much independence do we give them in sense
yeah.
of like, can they go down to the kitchen on their own? I mean, that's the level we're at the moment.
Yeah, yeah,
they're
well,
four.
They're only four, yeah.
And I'm like, no, you need to be with them all the time. And he's like, they need to feel like they're independent people, like we trust them,
yeah.
that we're not hovering over them all the time. And that, I know, is going to be a debate throughout, you know, our parenting.
Yeah, all these things come out. They really do. We've got, Richard and I, we're quite similar on loads of things, but there's definitely things, probably our biggest debate is about how much we encourage them, either encourage or are a bit more firm about insisting mm-hmm. on things like music lessons. Because I'm
right.
actually very chilled. I'm like, you can have the lessons, but I'm not going to stand over you saying
mm-hmm.
you should practice. Because I'm like, the piano's there.
Mm-hmm.
You're either going to want to do it or you're not. But he thinks, no, it should be a bit more like...
pushing.
You do 5 minutes of practice every day.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel really quite differently about it. And I don't actually think I'm right. It's just that I can't make myself into the sort of person that stands over them. So it's really more that. But every household, it's amazing what comes out. And I would say, it's funny hearing you say about the kids, the four-year-olds going to the kitchen on their own, because my four-year-old is the fourth one down. So I probably don't really know where he is half the time. That's the beauty of a big family. You can really go under the radar. Your daughter will experience that. You'll be somewhere with your twins and then your daughter will be off like...
no, juggling
party.
Knives.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what happens. That's the benefit.
She's
She'll be
fine.
Like... oh, yeah. that's the beauty. So that was my chat with the lovely Hadley Freeman. Thank you so much for having me over to yours, Hadley. Love talking to you. And also the book that she's written, House of Glass, is wonderful. I really recommend it. And not only was that the end of my chat, but the end of my series. My first series of Spinning Plates. Thank you so much for being part of all this with me. I've really enjoyed myself. I've really enjoyed having time that I can put aside just to have these incredible conversations with so many amazing women. And now I look to you to tell me who else I should be speaking to, please. I do read all the comments, so please put a comment and let me know who else you think I should be a good guest. I'm keen to cast my net far and wide, and it's been so nice for me to approach people I've never met before, but I just think sound kind of cool. And I have time to speak to them. So thank you to all my guests. Thank you to you for listening. Thank you to my amazing producer and friend, Claire Jones. Claire Jones has been part of this whole thing with me. She is someone I've known since I was a teenager when she was a lodger at my mum's house. She's a good friend of my mum's too. But Claire is an amazing radio producer and also has been incredibly supportive and encouraging with me with all of this. So thank you, Claire. You've been wonderful. I want to thank Richard, who my husband, who is unwittingly... especially with everything that's been going on with lockdown and all that stuff, he has unwittingly become my editor. So I know that wasn't what you intended, darling, but thank you so much. He's given me loads of his time and support, so I really appreciate him doing that too. And that's kind of us for the team, really. Got the lovely Ella May, who's done all the amazing artwork.
And lucky for me, all of us will be back for the next series, which starts again in a month. And yeah, send me your suggestions. I've already recorded a few and I'm very excited about the people I've been speaking to. And I've got an amazing wish list, of course, but keep me adding to it. Keep pushing me to talk to new folk. So thank you. It's been lovely. I've adored it. And for something that I wasn't sure what kind of shape it was going to be, I think Spinning Plates has become actually a very important part of my life, because apart from anything else, it's probably the longest conversations I've had that don't get interrupted by small people or, you know, other stuff, probably all year. It's the time when I press record on the little dictaphone, and then I'm just allowed to just be nosy and curious. Isn't that great fun? And I hope I've been asking the sort of questions you want me to ask of people. But the feedback's been lovely, and thank you. It really means a lot to me. So, yeah, I'm basically just sat here feeling very, very happy about things. That's a nice way to end, isn't it? See you in a month. Lots of love. Look after yourselves.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.